Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, plus a fun little chaser at the end of today's podcast. Jim, let's start with the good martini, and we will be focusing on a lot of diligent work that you did to see just how much trouble the Republicans are in 2018 when it comes to their efforts to keep the majority in the House of Representatives. One of the things we made as our bad martini several days ago was a relatively large number of Republican retirements, including a large number of committee chairmen, which suggests either they're just sick of it or they don't think they're going to have that position when the next Congress convenes in 2019. The Democrats had pretty good elections towards the end of 2017. They won in Alabama. They did well in Virginia. They did very well in New Jersey. And so just how much of a catbird seat are they in here heading into 2018? And you looked at the open Republican seats and found that for the vast majority of them, just looking at the data from the past election and trends from those districts, that things are looking pretty darn good for Republicans. There are some definite trouble spots out there, like Ed Royce and Daryl Issa retiring in California and Ileana Ross-Layton in Florida. And obviously there could be some incumbents who face very tough races. But for those wringing their hands a lot over the retirements, it's not necessarily looking that bad at all.
No, it isn't, Greg. And it's one of those things I just kind of felt like it was worth looking at this closer. It was back in 2010, early in the cycle, where the editors of National Review said, "Hey, Jim, could you look at it, do an article where you looked at every vulnerable House Democrat in every open seat race?" And I said, "What, are you kidding me? There's tons of them." Like, "Yeah, go ahead, do it." And I believe I ended up with 99 open seats or vulnerable House Democrats. And I originally wanted to make the title of the article, "I got 99 problems, but Pelosi ain't one." Now, at that point, I remember that one, you know, stretching into some, you know, Democratic plus six districts and things like that. But I believe it was, how much did they weigh? Was it 62 seats in the 2010 midterms?
Right around there, yeah.
And so I remember looking at this one, and the House is complicated. Nobody really knows the district lines the same way people know if I say Texas. Okay, well, you kind of have a picture of what Texas is in your head, or California, or Ohio, or Pennsylvania. The district lines are different, and you know there are some parts of the states that are very heavily Republican, some parts that are very heavily Democrat, and some that are in the middle. Well, you go through all of them, and I would urge everyone to read my piece, not just because I think everyone should read everything I write, but also because once you go into the history of some of these districts and you realize, you know, these are places where Democrats haven't won since 1980. One of the seats in, you know, a Schuster district in central Pennsylvania has been represented by Schuster or his father since going back to 1973. There's a Tennessee district where Democrats haven't won since the 1850s. These are very Republican districts. And a bunch of them actually, like one district in Idaho, yes, a Democrat won once in 2008. It was kind of a fluke of a wave year. And then the Republicans won it back the next district, and it hasn't been competitive since. A lot of districts are like that. I went through it, and basically about two-thirds, 25 out of the 34 seats are seats where Trump won in 2016 by 10 percentage points or more. In some of them, it was a 20-point, 30-point, even 40-point margin. So, I mean, could a Democrat win these seats? Look, anything is conceivably possible. We live in a world where Dave Brott beat Eric Cantor, but by and large, you would expect, unless there's just an unbelievable wave that makes 2006 look mild, you're going to see a lot of, you know, the open seats will be, you know, that are currently held by Republicans. Most of them will end up being held by Republicans. There's a good chance that really only maybe 10 or even less are actually competitive. Kind of pleased. Most of the people I respect the most have looked at what I've written today, kind of checked the math, checked the history, and said, yeah, this sounds about right. Now, look, there are House Republicans who are incumbents who could get beaten by Democrats. It's not like this is a guarantee Republicans will keep the House. But also worth noting, there are 15 Democrats who are retiring from the House. Some are running for Senate or governor or other positions. Some are just retiring outright. Worth noting that there are at least a handful. I counted four. Your mileage may vary, but there's two in Nevada, one in South Minnesota, and one in New Hampshire that has flipped, five times in the past seven cycles. So there are swing districts where Republicans could pick up seats, and each one of those makes it a little bit better chances for Republicans to keep the House. So all in all, the outlook for Republicans in the House, not nearly as bad as some of the coverage would suggest. And it's another indicator. You got to look beyond the quote unquote generic ballot numbers and other indicators saying, oh, the Democrats have a great chance of taking back the House. You look at it seat by seat. It's a little bit tougher than I think that conventional wisdom would have you believe.
Well, that's certainly good news. Good work on your part, Jim, to dig into each one of those districts that's got an open seat from a Republican and Democratic perspective coming into 2018. And for those incumbents, as well as just for the general Republican mood, I'll say it again. Do what you promised. Pass some stuff that you told people that you were going to pass, and that probably helped you get elected in the first place. Might help you get reelected or hold some of those open seats. And if the president focuses more on policy than tweeting, that might help a little bit as well. Speaking of the president keeping his mouth shut, let's move on to our bad martini now, Jim. And the president, before heading off to Davos yesterday, had a brief interaction with the reporters, I believe, in the Oval Office. And the question came up pretty early on as to whether or not he would testify for Bob Mueller in the special counsel investigation of Russia's influence in the 2016 elections. And here's how that conversation played out, at least for about 40 seconds worth.
Are you going to talk to Mueller? I'm looking forward to it, actually.
Do you have a date set?
There's been no collusion whatsoever. There's no obstruction whatsoever. And I'm looking forward to it.
Would you do it under oath, Mr. President?
You mean like Hillary did it under oath? Who said that?
I said that. Would you do it under oath?
Did Hillary do it under oath?
I have no idea, but I'm not asking you.
I think you have an idea. Do you really not have an idea?
I really don't remember.
I'll give you an idea. She didn't do it under oath. I would do it. And you know she didn't do it under oath.
She had to reach a higher standard. You would do it under oath.
Oh, I would do it under oath.
You would, yeah.
Absolutely.
A little bit hard to hear, perhaps, some of that, Jim. Hilarious that some in the press corps there didn't realize that Hillary never testified under oath in the FBI investigation into her server and the classified information and all that. Trump, though, being eager to testify and willing to do it under oath. We'll see if any of that actually happens. His lawyers are negotiating with the Mueller team. Obviously, from what we've seen, Mueller is not just looking at malfeasance during the 2016 campaign. He's more than happy to prosecute on process crimes here, like false statements and potentially obstruction of justice. So, Jim, this seems like a dicey idea in general, but the president seems like he's willing to do it. This perhaps wouldn't turn out very well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if President Trump recalls or is aware of the fact, but yes, Hillary Clinton was not under oath when she was questioned by the FBI, but it's illegal to lie to the FBI, period. Several of us pointed to her answers to the FBI and the notes from the FBI and said, look, if you say I was never briefed on how to handle classified information, or I don't recall, and you signed an official document under penalty of perjury declaring that you had indeed been briefed on how to handle classified information, well, at one point or another, you've committed a crime. You've either committed perjury when you signed the document, or you lied to the FBI and gave dishonest answers. But either way, if you're good, the lesson of recent history for everyone, both in politics and everything else, yes, it is a good thing to cooperate with law enforcement, but you probably want a lawyer when you're talking to the FBI. I don't think there's any doubt that, look, a good portion of this investigation is attempting to see, has the president committed any crimes, or is there any basis for an impeachment? It's possible Mueller comes back and says, yeah, no, everything's fine. But my guess is Mueller does not intend to do that. If you're Donald Trump, I understand the instinct of saying, oh, I've got nothing to hide. I've done nothing wrong. I'll answer any question. But, I was glad to see Ty Cobb come out and say, effectively, no, the president didn't mean any of that. We're going to negotiate over what topics are under discussion and things like that. My sense is that the president, it would be wise to be careful. You can go back and find some very funny transcripts of Trump in civil cases where he gets tied up and, contradicting himself pretty darn quickly in circumstances like this. We've all seen Trump kind of with his bombast and rhetorical excess, shall we say, and things where he's just not careful about how he words things and how he describes things. You know, at what point does exaggeration turn into lying under oath? I would not want to risk that if I were the president of the United States. I would want to be very careful about this and just assume Mueller, probably all things being equal, would rather come back and say, this is, I believe the president has committed a crime. than not do that just because he doesn't want to be seen as wasting everyone's time. So I can understand why the president's saying, yeah, I got nothing to hide. But if he really does follow through on this, I think he's going to have his lawyers, tearing their hair out.
There's no upside for him to do this, even if there was nothing for him to hide here. Just as you said, the potential danger here so greatly outweighs anything else. It's just a fool's errand to go down this road and oblige for that. But we'll see what happens. Jim, let's go to the crazy martini now. And I take you to a blast from your past, the 2004 presidential campaign and the Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry, who, of course, for many years was a senator from Massachusetts. And in the second 4 years of the Obama administration, served as Secretary of State. This is courtesy of the Free Beacon. Former Secretary of State John Kerry told a Palestinian official that he is seriously considering running for president in 2020, according to a report in Israeli media. The Hebrew language paper Ma'ariv reported that Kerry recently met with Hussein Aga, a close associate of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, in London, according to the Jerusalem Post. The former top diplomat in the Obama administration told Aga not to yield to President Donald Trump, and that Trump may not even be in office next year. Kerry then surprised Aga by saying he was, quote-unquote, seriously considering a White House run in 2020. When asked about his advanced age, he said he was not much older than Trump and would not have an age problem, according to the Jerusalem Post. Kerry is 3 years older than Trump and would be 77 years old if, in fact, he took the office in January of 2021. So, Jim, putting aside the fact that if a former Republican Secretary of State told a foreign official not to deal with the current Democratic administration, there'd be a lot of chirping about the Logan Act. What do you make of John Kerry suggesting a comeback to the White House campaign trail 16 years after coming up short?
Greg, let me tell you, much like John Kerry himself, I am reporting for duty. Look, the Kerry spot was a very big and important moment in my career. So I've always had a little bit of a soft spot for the nattering nincompoop who constantly steps in it, who comes across as arrogant and buffoonish and hilariously out of touch and all that stuff. And I almost found myself with a smidgen of sympathy for John Kerry, keeping in mind that, yes, I think he'd be terrible at the job. I think the country made the right call in 2004. I don't think he'd be a particularly strong candidate. I could very easily see Trump tweaking him during debates endlessly. I could see could you imagine John Kerry trying to go after somebody else for not earning his wealth? Or Trump would call him ketchup boy or something like that. There's all kinds of ways this could go badly. But I'll take an unusual stance, and I will say, let me observe something. We just saw earlier this year the 24 to 48 hour bonanza of excitement over Oprah running for president. A little bit earlier, we heard about Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. You hear names like The Rock, although he says he's not interested in the 2020 cycle. And there's already this congressman from Maryland, John Mulaney, who said, I'm running for president in 2020. I'm doing it. Look, John Kerry's got a lot of flaws, but he is qualified to be president of the United States. And in that, I mean, he is a carbon-based life form who is an American citizen over 35 years of age, but even more, he spent his, oodles of time in the Senate and he was Secretary of State. He won the Democratic nomination back in 2004. By traditional standards, this is the sort of experience you want to have in a presidential candidate, right? I mean, we don't like what John Kerry says. We don't really trust his judgment, but he does know what he's talking about. He's not doing this because he wants to build a brand. He's not doing this because he was really good on a reality TV show. He's not doing this for attention. Well, maybe he is a little bit, but the point being there is that John Kerry, if nothing else, is a serious, veteran lawmaker who actually knows this kind of stuff. And, if he, by some miracle, he did win the Democratic nomination, it would kind of be a pushback against this celebrityfication of our politics. He at the very least would be a serious candidate as opposed to these, the no names who I think are basically aspiring for future offices or TV gigs or something like that. I understand Mitch Landrieu is apparently a very good mayor of New Orleans, but I just don't think you jump from mayor of New Orleans to president of the United States. I don't think you and I have talked about Tulsi Gabbard a bunch of times, Seth Moulton, practically the entire Senate Democratic caucus. Most of these people just got there, were elected 10 minutes ago, and they're already saying, oh, I'm ready to be president of the United States. And I'd like to think our experience from not just this celebrity president, but perhaps previous celebrity presidents, we would say, you know what? There's something to be said for known quantities. There's something to be said for people who have spent their lives in government and passing laws and studying policy and dealing with this stuff instead of people who are doing it as a lark. And yes, I realize everybody hates Washington insiders and Jim, we don't want somebody who spent their whole life in government or something like that. Well, look, I think a good chunk of the challenges that President Trump is facing involve the fact that he's, for example, that he hasn't spent his life in government. So he doesn't know where the bodies are buried. He doesn't know how the system works. He doesn't know all the levers to pull. Things like the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission go without commissioners because there's nobody around to say, you need to do this, right? He's got a very much a, with the exception of Pence, Reince Priebus was a party chair guy. Ivanka, Jared, Gary Cohn is from Wall Street, Steve Bannon. Kellyanne Conway was a pollster. These are not people who worked in government before. And I think a lot of those early stumbles stem from the fact that they were all rookies. They were all kind of learning how all the system worked while they were in the jobs. And I'm not a big fan of that stuff. So in that sense, that is as strong an endorsement I can give to John Kerry, besides the fact that I think covering him again would be hilarious. And we still have all the old waffle graphics and all that kind of stuff. So let's go, John Kerry. I don't know what John Edwards is doing these days. Let's get the band back together. Let's have a lot of fun. If Murphy Brown is coming back to TV, we should bring back all of our old beloved classics from past decades. If that's not a good segue, Greg, I don't know what is.
Exactly. Perfect segue for bringing back the classic shows. What about classic sports leagues?
This is the XFL.
Ah, the XFL. One glorious, well, not really, season almost two decades ago now, but it's coming back. CBS News, as if 2017 was not crazy enough, 2018 has fired its opening salvo as the return of the XFL, a controversial football league originally founded by Vince McMahon in 1999, will be officially announced on Thursday. Sources close to the situation confirmed to CBS Sports. While the return of the XFL will be made official Thursday, CBS Sports has also learned the league is not expected to start up again until 2020. That's a difference from the last time when McMahon rushed the original XFL into existence. Also, this is not going to be a WWE-sponsored venture this time. McMahon has sold a decent amount of stock to help create something called Alpha Entertainment, and he's got other investors coming on board to try and get this going with a little more stability this time. So, Jim, I look forward to people, you know, competing for the ball to see who gets the possession first like they did last time. I certainly hope Jesse Ventura is not back in the broadcast booth. But if we can get a quality product on the field at a time when the NFL is having some public relations difficulties, shall we say, might not be the worst thing.
You know, Greg, there are a couple of big questions that still need to be resolved. Among them, does the current Democratic governor of Minnesota want to do color commentary? That's another tradition I assume they'd be keeping there. This is a it was kind of a disaster. A lot of ideas seemed flawed from the start. High among them, you know, they mostly picked cities that already had well-established NFL franchises. And Greg, I remember I think the first game was like mid-February and they were playing in either Giants Stadium or the Meadowlands. And, you know, like guys are out there with their shirts off in February, you know, to watch a bunch of play. All the games were at night. So you're watching it, you know, it's freezing February nights in cities, you know, after the regular football season had begun. All of the players, of course, are those who are generally not good enough to make the NFL. A couple that did end up eventually making it the NFL, including He Hate Me, right, Greg?
Yeah, he made it, as did Tommy Maddox, ended up as the Steelers quarterback.
There you go. Yeah, a couple players were actually NFL. It's about what you come to expect from back in the 70s. They had the World Football League, the USFL, the NFL Europe, the expansion league they had for the kind of practice squad players and things like that. Look, the quality of the play is not going to be that good. Football really generally was violent enough. The idea that, oh, we're going to make it rougher and nastier, blah, you know. I don't think it really needed it. And my suspicion is that as much as people really like football, there's an off season for a reason. People turn their attentions to basketball and hockey and you know, more traditional winter sports. We'll see how things go, Greg. I did take a little bit of time earlier on Twitter to kind of come up with some potential franchise names. I tried to think of mostly cities that don't have NFL franchises, a couple that did, but I also thought about like what actually frightens people about those cities. So my understanding, Greg, is that the opening franchises involved in this version of the XFL will feature the New York cost of living, the Philadelphia cholesterol, the Washington Partisans.
Good.
Also, I like the idea of the Orlando humidity. I was hoping there'd be a NBA franchise that would name its team the humidity. So when they beat the Miami Heat, you could chant, "It's not the heat, it's the humidity." You know, Portland hipsters. I mean, nothing is more insufferable or difficult to deal with or frustrating than those. Occasionally you see teams go with kind of a singular word, you know, DC United and things like that for their thing. So I kind of like the idea of the St. Louis Abandoned. You want to talk about a city that probably could use some football right about now? I think St. Louis probably would count for that. The Sacramento Regulators. We talked about California earlier in the week. And of course, you know, probably most people understand this reference. I would like a group of fans to put on their very best and go root in Southern California for the San Diego Class.
You stay classy, San Diego. Very good. Yeah, very well positioned with the nicknames, as well as reaching out to those communities that have been jilted by the NFL. Maybe they should put a professional team in Cleveland, too.
Somewhere Hugh Hewitt is cursing at us and reminding us that they've got the first and fourth picks in the draft.
Yeah, I know. It's a bold statement for a Bears fan to make fun of another city's professional football team. But, you know, you take what you can get. Jim, we'll see what happens with the XFL if it actually gets off the ground. Fun to talk about, though. Jim, you're actually out for the next few days. I believe we'll see you again on Wednesday.
That's my plan, Greg. See you then.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. David French will be in for Jim on Friday. Please join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.